This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Rogues, Renegades and Robin Hood, our favourite outlaws in speculative fiction.
Oh, Robin.
Are you thinking of the Disney fox?
Maybe. He was foxy.
Funnily enough.
See what I did there?
I think there's something about the mythology of Robin Hood that captures the imagination, though, because think how many adaptations there have been.
Yeah, far too many.
Hundreds. And some are good and some are terrible.
Less good. we did say it would be about renegades, but I think mostly this is going to be an entire episode about us sort of gushing over Robin Hood, who is a fantastic character.
Yes. Earliest mentioned sort of narrative ballad is 1377, the Piers Plowman. But the earliest surviving narrative ballads date to the late 15th century.
Yes.
And obviously Robin Hood is nearly always set, any of them, I think one of the original ones was called Robin Hood and the Monk, but they're nearly always set in sort of the 13th century, during the time of unrest when John was seat-warming his brother's throne and Richard the Lionheart was off, you know, banging nice-looking French dudes and conquering the Saracens. You know, everyone sort of lauds him up as being like a great king, but he wasn't in the kingdom very often.
No, he was awful. Just driving the country, murdered everyone, had sex with a lot of people, took over Cyprus briefly, and yeah, was just generally awful, to be honest.
It just shows what you can do with good PR, though, because his legend is always, oh, you know, he had the courage of a lion, he was such a man kind of thing. And
yeah, good King Richard.
You do know he was gay, not that there's anything wrong with that, but everyone's like, oh yeah, he's the epitome of what a king should be, he was so, you know, masculine. And you're like, well, yeah, maybe he was, but have you considered this aspect?
He was bankrupting the country.
Yes.
And everyone sort of blames John.
Yeah,
for the whole kind of the taxing thing, and I'm like, John was pretty much just trying to keep the country going because Richard was busy bankrupting everything.
Yeah, I mean, John was no paragon of virtue, and the punishments he meted out to people were horrific, even for the time, which, considering it was sort of like the 13th century, that was really horrific. If you got written down as a horrific person for punishing, then they had to be really pretty bad, because no one really blinked an eye at cutting your hand off if you were a thief back then.
So. Yeah, so, well done, John, in that respect. You managed to win that title. But yeah, I think very much people liked Richard because he wasn't there to prove them wrong.
Yeah. And what's interesting about Robin Hood that doesn't often get, you don't often go into it very much unless you're, say, looking at something like Ivanhoe, is the fact that it's sort of set against the backdrop of a couple of centuries of unrest with the class system that was set up between the Normans and the Saxons, where the Saxons were very much kept as an underclass, and the Normans obviously had built all these great stone castles and were considered more the upper crust. And you had the country speaking both French and Old English at the time. So it really was a very divided nation at the time.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, I believe in The Sword and the Stone, they actually have Robin Hood appearing in the book and sort of spend some time with what's his face? With Arthur and co.
I think I might have blanked that out because the whole time thing just didn't work for me. I think you're right.
Yeah, and in that case, he was a Saxon. And that was his thing, that he was a Saxon. And obviously, Arthur was one of the Nords. So, awkward.
Well, slightly. Yeah, that's a lot of time folding right there, isn't it, really?
just a tiny bit of...
That's about 400 or 500 years all in one afternoon. That's probably why I blanked that out.
Well, I mean, it's not the most unbelievable thing they did in that book.
No, I suppose not. I'm still a bit more down with them turning into squirrels and fish and stuff.
The squirrels and fish I could get away with, but Robin Hood, no.
No, absolutely not. But looking at, say, Ivanhoe, which was by Sir Walter Scott, who wrote some brilliant romances and some very peculiar ones. Ivanhoe himself is a Saxon nobleman who's been serving with the rest of, well, you know, if you were a knight, you were supposed to be going out to conquer the Holy Land. That was your duty as a knight. And I think he's obviously thought better of it. But, you know, having Ivanhoe and Robin Hood working together in that novel kind of worked. Because even though Ivanhoe sort of looks down on Robin Hood because Robin Hood's an outlaw, Robin Hood's real main goal in that is to get the right king put back on the throne. And, you know, John's got the church coming in and he's allowing the Norman Lord Brian de Bois Guilbert to do all sorts of heinous things as well. And it's a really rich textured novel because you look at things like, you know, you had a lot of travelling Jews coming through England as traders and things for all through those centuries. And they were both welcomed and persecuted. So they look at that and it really looks at lots of different things within that time period. So it was quite an advanced novel for when it was written, which was the 18th century.
Yeah.
And Robin Hood's quite a rich character in that. And so is Ivanhoe, even though, you know, in some respects he's absolutely stupid in the sense I love Rowena, I'll marry Rowena. Oh, but I'm kind of having an affair with this hot Jewish chick. Rebecca as well. And it's like, you really think that's going to go over well with your, you know, fiance? Because it's probably not. And also, she can't marry you because you're a Gentile. Anyway, aside, if you want a little portrait of Robin Hood, sort of separate from some of the original narrative ballads, Ivanhoe's a pretty good one to go for.
Yeah. I wonder what it is about Robin Hood that really, really gets us.
I think it's the portrayal of him robbing from the rich and giving to the poor, which when you think about it, isn't necessarily a good thing because you don't know why people have, you know, are in the situation they are. But if you take it on face value, as in it's all been entirely luck and birth and the people at the top who have all the money are enjoying grinding the poor down into the dirt and the poor are actually good, decent working people who don't get the fruits of their own labours, then the idea that there's someone out there who wants to redress the balance and make life fair is very, very appealing.
Yeah. And there is one version of the story where if you were caught by Robin and he asked you how much money you had on you, if you lied, he would take everything. If you told him the truth and you said how much money you had on you, he would let you go. I think he would only take a little bit of it and let you go.
Yeah.
So it was, again, it was this idea of honesty. It wasn't about the rich. It was about the dishonest rich.
I think it was the fact also that he was a lovable rogue as well, wasn't he? I mean, as we've said, this was the original narratives probably predate this, but they go back to 1377.
Yeah.
And you know, that's sort of just after when the tales were probably being told around Richard the Lionheart and, you know, various other things. And it was that. There's a real divisive class system, as I've said. So, you know, as we mentioned, and as you've said as well, he doesn't necessarily penalise people who are honest, even if they are part of, say, they would have been part of the Normans, probably.
Yeah.
Because the Normans did hold almost all the land and wealth. I won't go and do a complete history lesson on it, because it wouldn't interest anyone. But, you know, it was really interesting the way it was set up. And it was set up that way to keep the Saxons down, because the Saxons did not want Norman overlords.
No. And interestingly enough, kind of in the later versions, it was that Robin was actually Robin of Locksley.
Yes.
And I think in some versions he was actually a Norman himself then, wasn't he?
Earl of Huntingdon, but disgraced.
Yeah, disgraced because he sort of disagreed with the sheriff.
Yeah, the sheriff of Nottingham wanted to take his land and holdings. So plotted against him, basically. It's an interesting point here, and it's something the Disney cartoon goes into, is when we say sheriff over here in the UK, not that we say it very often, we don't mean sheriff with, you know, a nice sort of fedora and a gun and a star badge, sort of in the Wild West sense of the word. A sheriff here was a fairly lowly lord who collected taxes for their, you know, for the higher lord of their area and controlled a contingent. So yes, he would be the lawman for the area in the sense of you would bring things in front of him for adjudication in the same way that they used to before the Saxon jarls and, you know, later with the Norman lords, because the king was not going to preside over every single little dispute that ever happened in a district.
No.
Kings are busy people. So that's what the sheriff did. He was sort of like, you had a That was the beginning of the feudal system. So he wasn't going around knocking on doors and collecting taxes himself. He would have sent his men round to do it, which is where you had Guy of Gisborne as well. Again, a step down from, say, the Sheriff of Nottingham himself.
Yeah.
But the Sheriff of Nottingham would have been low nobility.
But nobility nonetheless.
Yes.
And I think his character was this someone who is taking complete advantage of his position.
Yeah, very much so. And it would have been, if you think hypothetically, quite easy to do at the time, because you have the true king out of the kingdom, you know, amusing himself with sex and violence, and you have his brother, who isn't really king on the throne, so doesn't have the full authority, and the person they might have listened to, Eleanor of Aquitaine, was elsewhere, and she was trying not to get too much in her son's business, although there is historical record that she did in fact interfere a few times when she thought, oh god, they're just messing this up completely.
Oh god, you're awful. All of you are awful.
It's like, I provide two decent sons and look at what they're doing. You know, I ruled this country fine, thank you. As queen consort.
Yeah, how have you messed this up already? So, yeah.
So there would have been plenty of opportunity to get around people. There would have been unrest. John was not a liked person.
No, he wasn't. And yeah, but it is an interesting thing where, in a very similar way to the Arthurian myths, you have a character who originally started out as being a representative of sort of lower classes or the repressed people, who then became something kind of entirely different. And Robin Hood didn't change too much. His morals didn't change. So just as Arthur became what was once, you know, the revolutionary figure against the oppressors or the invaders. Yeah, Robin Hood starts off as a Saxon, but kind of becomes a nobleman instead. A nobleman with a good heart.
Yes. Now, whether or not he would have been that way if he hadn't have been driven into outlawry, we don't know.
Yeah, or whether the reason he was driven into outlawism is because he was that way.
Yeah, it could have gone either way. But that, I think the idea was that he disagreed with a particular order or bribe and would not fall into line.
Yeah.
And depending on whether he was Saxon, whether he was Norman, we don't know whether it's based on a historical character, to be honest.
Mm.
In that respect, either way, he ended up going and living in Nottingham Forest. Nottingham Forest is not very big anymore. Nottingham Forest is more sort of Nottingham Copse, which is unfortunate. But if you think back to the 13th century, most of Britain was covered in forest.
Yeah.
And if you had any sort of woodcraft at all, you could live reasonably well out there. I mean, you weren't supposed to kill the deer, but because all the deer in England belong to the king or the crown, so without permission, you can't kill them. Same as the swans. Not that I'm suggesting anyone should eat a swan. I've gone on for a tangent anyway.
don't eat swans. They're really gross.
You've tried?
No, I'm just saying swans are gross as animals.
Oh, right. Okay.
Like, they're the filthiest birds ever. They'll eat anything. They're like, just awful. Don't eat swans.
Same with geese, really.
Yeah. But swans are even worse.
But yeah, if you've got any sort of wild woodcraft type skill, then you can live out in a decent sized set of woods for quite a long time. And obviously, as the narratives go on through the centuries, more and more characters get added. For example, you've got John Little and Friar Tuck and Will Scarlet. And who's the other one? Is it
Much?
That's the one. Much.
Oh, Much.
And there's all sorts of folk adventures around all of them. And it's, you know, it's great. I mean, one of the most famous ones. You know, I'll try and keep this vaguely organised. What Robin Hood was supposedly well known for was his prowess with a bow. A longbow. And the English longbow changed the face of warfare for us for a very long time, culminating in the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, when we should not have won against the French army.
No.
And instead, we absolutely slaughtered them.
Yeah, in one of the most decisive battles. I feel like we should just talk a little bit about the Battle of Agincourt, because it's worth a little bit of a speech. So this is the idea. This is, whose army was it? It was Henry the... Henry?
Yes, it was Henry.
Yeah, Henry V?
Henry, I think it was Henry the Fifth. Sorry, this is, we bear in mind we've got eight Henrys, so
we've got a lot of Henrys, okay? So I think it was Henry the Fifth. So he'd been marching his army through France, and at this point they had a few prisoners and they were all dying of dysentery, and it was awful. And there was very, very few of them left. And then they got met by this huge, and I think pretty much all of them were on foot as well. So then they were met by this huge French army, which was like 3-4 times as big as them. And fortunately, the weather was in the Englishman's favour because it had been raining and it was wet and muddy.
And if there's one thing the English can deal with, it's rain, because we get a lot of it. The English army was pretty ill-equipped, apart from these longbows that they had. The French army was well-equipped. They had lovely shiny armour, which bogged them down in the thick mud.
Yes, and they were also very, very confident because they saw how badly the English army were doing. So, what happened next is that the French army sort of just launched straight into an attack. And Henry got all of his longbowmen to just unleash this barrage of arrows down on them. And he made them hold their ground. And also he did something that was quite rare, is that he killed the prisoners that they had.
Yeah.
So that when the army came round the back, they couldn't free them and then sort of have even more. Now, usually the prisoners would be kept. It was kind of like sort of ye old sort of exchange student system. They'd usually be kept quite well, you know, it was sort of like, oh, you've caught me, all right, I guess I'd better come to England then. It was actually usually quite civilised. But... yeah, in this case, he just murdered them all, which was probably part of the reason why he survived. And yeah, the French army, just the first line got slaughtered. And then the next sort of line came in and they weren't really paying attention to what they were doing. And they got bogged down and sort of all crushed each other. And so they were all sort of boxed into this one tiny place with arrows just raining down on them.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's pretty much how they won.
And they were, yeah, they were just absolutely slaughtered by basically the English longbowmen. And a longbow has got a hell of a range on it, so we were killing them before they got anywhere near us.
Yeah. And that, children, is why you should never be overconfident in a battle.
I think the thing was, they just kept going. There was no plan B, because, you know, he just basically decided, well, we'll just send them all in. We've got superior troops.
Yeah.
And, you know, while quantity hath a quality all of its own, it is nearly always quality over quantity in the end, particularly if you're willing to carry the battle to the enemy, which is what Henry V did.
Yeah. There's also an element of the fact that Henry literally had nothing to lose at that point. He's like, well, we either die or we don't, so I guess we just try this.
Yeah, yeah. There was definitely an element of that as well.
And it worked.
And it worked.
Well done, Henry.
So, I mean, I don't know how much of Robin Hood being this fantastic archer and swordsman as well, but mostly archer is what we remember him for, with an English longbow, does actually date back to the 13th century, and how much of it was added after the Battle of Agincourt. Because at that time, after that battle, if you were a longbowman, I bet you never had to buy a round in a pub ever again.
Yeah, because they're strong as well.
Yes, I mean, if they looked at skeletons of, you know, men, skeletons of bodies, men who were allegedly part of the army for the Battle of Agincourt, and the musculature on one side has completely deformed the bones and made the bones much thicker on that side, so they've actually got this strange sort of hunched shoulder type appearance.
Mm.
And you had to be massively strong to be able to draw a longbow as well.
Yeah, they were very difficult to draw. Very, very heavy. So yeah, you have this this figure then, and I think that probably the Battle of Agincourt did draw into that, because suddenly being a bowman wasn't about cowardice anymore.
No, there was real skill involved, which feeds into one of my favourite Robin Hood legends, which is where it's either the Sheriff of Nottingham or King John, or both of them together, try to tempt him out of the Nottingham Forest by holding an archery competition.
<That's>
and Robin's like, well, I'm obviously the best archer, so I have to attend. It's like, no, Robin, it's a trap. It's like, no, I'll be fine. I'll go in disguise.
I think that pretty much every kind of Robin Hood series has done a gimmick of that.
Yeah. It's one of the most enduring ones, I think.
Yeah, in the, like, they did it in the Fox movie.
Yeah.
And it's in the BBC version as well.
I'm pretty sure it's in the Kevin Costner Robin Hood Prince of Thieves film, which is so cheesy, but I'm kind of fond of it anyway. And
yep.
It's definitely in the really old Errol Flynn Robin Hood, which I also love.
So there you go. We just love Robin Hood.
But it's something that just gets reimagined time after time. And it is this cockiness as well, the display of skill, but also the fact that he's like, yeah, okay, I know it's a trap, I'm just going to walk into it and I'll be fine anyway.
Yeah. And he always was as well. He always managed to get away with it.
Yes.
Sort of terrify everyone because they were just convinced he was going to die.
As a little sidestep, around the same sort of time, about a century or so later, you've got William Tell in Switzerland, who, and this was set around, again, the narratives that are actually written down surviving at the end of the 15th century. So around the same time that, you know, Robin Hood was really written down and recorded. Now, I'm just going to have to check something here because my William Tell facts are not quite as good. But he's kind of a Swiss Robin Hood. He was known as a strong man because it's Switzerland. He was also an expert mountain climber.
Of course.
Kind of need to be. And he was an expert with the crossbow, which is less hard to use than a longbow, but, you know, still requires a degree of skill. And they're pretty heavy as well. A full-size crossbow is pretty tough.
Yeah.
Anyway, this was Habsburg rule. Germany and Switzerland at the time were all sort of broken up into little provinces, and the Habsburgs were not terribly popular. They were basically trying to annex all of Switzerland, Germany, Austria into one big kingdom, and a lot of people didn't like this very much, including William Tell.
Yeah, I can imagine. So,
the Voigt of Altdorf? They raised a pole in the village of Lindentree. I'm not sure if that's actually a real place. And hung the Voigt of Altdorf's hat on top of it and demanded that all the townspeople bow before the hat. So basically, admit that you agree with Habsburg rule. And William Tell visited the place with his son, passed by the hat, and publicly refused to bow to it. And was arrested, because, you know, that was the thing. But Gessler, who was the Voigt of Altdorf, was intrigued by Tell's famed marksmanship and resentful of his defiance. And the most famous legend says that Tell can go free if he shoots the apple off the head of his son. Now, it doesn't matter how good you are with a crossbow, you don't want to point it at your own child, usually.
No, usually.
He has to do it in a single attempt and split the apple. Now, William Tell manages to do this because he's basically a 16th century rock star with a crossbow. But Gessler, the Voigt of Altdorf, notices that William Tell has removed two bolts from his quiver at the time, and before releasing him he asked why, and Tell eventually says, after Gessler's promise not to kill him, says that had he accidentally killed his own son, the second bolt was for Gessler himself. And then basically their relationship goes downhill from there.
Yeah,
if
that
it wasn't
surprise
already
me.
Doomed. But what's interesting is that while this is very definitely its own thing, and it's actually documented separately in the White Book of Saren, the Weißenbuch von Saren, is the fact that it mirrors a lot of the Robin Hood exploits. I mean, Robin Hood isn't known to have a son, but that whole sort of, you know, we're going to try and turn you against your family thing, which is what's allegedly happened with Robin of Locksley, is very interesting, really.
Yeah, he is a fascinating character, regardless of his origin. And there is possibly an element of truth to him, that he may very well be a real person, or based off real people.
Yeah, and the name Robin is actually a pet form of Robert.
Yeah.
It's become a name in its own right now. But it also pertains to, say, Robin Goodfellow, or to the man in green. So, you know, there's a lot of pagan mythology that feeds into it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I do like the whole thing. Sorry, that sounds really stupid, but I really do. That I don't know quite why I'm so charmed by Robin Hood, but he's a character who has managed to remain very earthly.
Yeah, I mean, you can't quite avoid it. I mean, you can't quite avoid being charmed. You can't quite avoid being on these sort of character sides. I mean, as a Scottish example, you've got Robert Roy MacGregor, who was a Scottish outlaw. Far less about the bow, a lot more about the Scottish hand and a half bastard sword.
Yeah.
And obviously, not just against the... I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that, despite what Outlander tells you, the Scots were not so much at war with the English during the 18th century. It was the Highland Scots against the rich Lowland Scots who were taking payoffs from the English and who had English troops stationed and garrisoned around there and were quite happy to persecute their own people in order to keep lots of money in their pockets. And Rob Roy MacGregor was actually... A folk hero in the sense of he's not happy about giving all his money to the Lowland Scots, which you can kind of understand.
Yeah, he basically said, enough.
Enough. So I think we were primed from you know, Robin Hood, the myth of Robin Hood has sort of primed us to be receptive to these sort of characters. So anybody who's... I'm sure that, say, Rob Roy, who was actually an actual historical figure, probably wasn't that great a guy. I mean, anyone who's willing to go to those sort of lengths probably isn't a particularly nice person. They're at least morally ambiguous. But we're primed, because of the fantastic PR job they did with Robin Hood, to be more sympathetic towards them, to think what great guys they are.
Yeah.
And it's the same. This is something that Elizabeth I fed into with her privateers. I mean, privateers are pirates. Pirates do nasty stuff. But, you know, Sir Walter Raleigh was like, what a guy. It's like, he's kind of like Lord Flashheart almost.
Yeah, I think that's who Lord Flashheart is kind of based on, isn't he?
And it was just a great spin. And while she may not have done that particularly herself, she certainly endorsed it. The Spanish hated our privateers. The French hated our privateers. We kept stealing their ships and all their stuff. And one thing the British were very good at was being pirates. So we were good at being not very nice bullies.
Yeah.
But again, we were all primed to be supportive of this because of this whole Robin Hood myth, in my opinion.
No, I agree with you. We allowed it. We sort of fell in love with it a little bit.
Yeah. And it's the same, once again, when you get to, and I don't know very much about this character, I'll be honest, but you get John Henry, who was kind of like a Robin Hood figure for the enslaved Americans.
Yeah.
As well. So anybody who feeds into that sort of thing, it's such an archetype now. And perhaps it predates, you know, the Robin Hood myth as well, but that one really crystallised it, I think, in the same way that the legends of King Arthur crystallised our longing for a one true king, you know?
If we have one true king, we'll be happy.
It's like the good days will come back again, the golden age will return kind of thing.
Yeah. If only. So, yeah. Who do you think is your favourite?
Favourite Robin? It's really difficult because I think they've all brought something different to it. I really do love the Disney film. I know a lot of people have called it cheesy, but it captures the spirit of the archetype.
Yeah.
I do love the Errol Flynn film. I don't know if you've ever seen it. I mean, it does date back to sort of the 1940s.
Yeah.
I obviously don't date back that far, and neither does my father, but my dad watched it as a little boy and kind of infected me with the same love for it, the same as The Seahawk, which also stars Errol Flynn. It's just an Errol Flynn sort of fan club going on, right? But basically, The Seahawk was all about Elizabeth I's privateers, which is why I can see the parallel there. You know, we love this rogue character who ultimately has a heart of gold, but is willing to do some pretty nasty stuff to get justice for the people.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think. I think I'm probably quite. It probably is going to have to be the fox.
Yeah.
I love that fox. And that's there's a lot of the sort of the films of Robin Hood. I mean, there was the recent film, I say recent, with Russell Crowe in it, which I wasn't a big fan of, to be
Oh, I'm sorry,
honest.
it had Russell Crowe and I refused to watch
Yeah.
it.
But the BBC one and the one with Morgan Freeman, where they were going through England and they ended up in Hadrian's Wall.
That was awesome. It's like you completely missed England entirely there, didn't you? Which way
Guys,
round?
Robin, I know it's been a while, but you're really lost.
Which way round from the east did you come that you managed to get all the way up to Scotland in order to come down?
Then get that sort of to Nottingham. I was like, ah, we're at, nearly at Nottingham. No, my friend, you have passed it. But yeah, was that they had a kind of arrogance to them.
Yeah.
They were quite arrogant, and that was sort of was their flaw. They were sort of kind of showboats as well, which makes sense. And I guess the reason I kind of like the Disney one so much is that yeah, Robin is a tiny bit of a showboat, but he at his core, really, he's a playful but deeply loving, deeply feeling, and deeply empathetic character who communicated so well with the people that he was caring for.
Yeah.
You know, he really was beloved, and yet somehow, despite being all of this, you could kind of believe him as a character.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wasn't too fussed about the BBC version, except that I really loved Richard Armitage in it. In fact, I'll watch Richard Armitage in anything, and also he had like total guyliner on in that, so that was cool.
He really did. He was
So
very moody.
I was paying absolutely no attention to the plot in that, and I will own up to it. I was basically just watching it for that one guy.
Yeah. The guy who plays Much, I think, is adorable. And apparently he's a really nice person as well, so there you go. I know someone who's worked. I know someone who knows someone who's worked with him, and apparently he's a lovely guy, so there you go. But I sort of I liked the cast of it. He's been in Ripper Street recently.
Oh, I haven't been watching that. I do keep meaning to.
Yeah, no, I do highly recommend it. And that's and he was fantastic in that. Very, very good actor. Very emotional. Interesting, in Ripper Street, he played this very conflicted character who again had this sort of heart of gold, but kept doing pretty awful things, to be honest.
Yeah.
But sort of not out of anything other than that the fact that this was a person who'd sort of been traumatized and was unwell, sort of mentally, but deep down, you know, was actually a good person deep down, and wanted to do right, and wanted to be gentle, and wanted to be kind. And I guess that's the thing. That's the version of Robin Hood that I really, really like is this gentleness. He was
Yeah.
very, you know, he's flashy. He's seen with the bow and stuff like that. But there was this kind of very gentle aspect about him, which is possibly why I didn't like him so much in sort of the film versions or the sort of the TV versions, where he had more of a pushy playboy element to him.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I don't suppose you'll remember this because this will be way before your time, but I watched it as a child with my dad, and it's the Robin of Sherwood series from, 1984 to 1986 with Michael Praed.
I think I've actually got it on my shelf, so
Ah,
I
but that was
might watch
more
it.
fantasy based, and it had the sort of pagan Herne the Hunter type elements to it as well, and was a lot grittier. And I really quite like the character in that as well.
Yeah.
And as one that's a bit spoofy is I but I loved it as a child was Maid Marian and Her Merry Men, where
Yes.
Robin is this callow, vain, cowardly person, and Maid Marian's doing all the work, and Robin's just swanning in, looking like perfect with his hair in the right place afterwards and taking all the credit.
Yeah, and but she's the smart one, he's the idiot.
Yeah, it's which was extremely funny and quite intelligently written, and that sort of brings us on to the question of Maid Marian, really,
Yeah.
who we haven't really mentioned.
She's an interesting one.
Yeah, she doesn't appear in the original narrative ballads and doesn't appear until sort of the 18th century in any of them, when I think a French poet sort of introduced her.
Yeah.
I can't remember who it was, but I'm pretty sure that that's kind of what happened.
I think you might be right. Yeah. She, I mean, I like her as a character.
Yeah,
And she's not a cowardly character either.
No, she was very much, again, in her time, rebelling in the same way that both Rebecca and Rowena were in Ivanhoe, for example.
And she falls in love with Robin, and she stays faithful to Robin despite the kind of the dangers and associated. And she's not a woman who is sort of taken by riches or anything like that, because she chooses to be with Robin in sort of in the middle of the forest. And usually she's depicted as very kind, very gentle, but not cowardly in the least.
Yeah.
Very firm and very strong. And so she has all of the attributes of an interesting and dynamic character, who isn't, I feel, often used to full effect.
No. Weirdly, there was another Robin Hood that came out at the same time as Robin Hood Prince of Thieves and didn't do very well, probably because of that. And I can't remember. It had Uma Thurman in it, that's right. It literally came out the same year, and Uma Thurman was playing Maid Marian in it, and Maid Marian actually absconds because she doesn't want to be part of an arranged marriage, you know, cuts her hair, dyes it, and joins the Band of Outlaws. And because she's disguised as a boy, Robin Hood treats her like shit. Sort of, you're not very strong, you need to cut the wood, you need to earn your place, kind of thing. But it was a really, really interesting dynamic. And it was actually the better film of the two, in my opinion.
What's it called? I might have to check that out.
It's actually called Robin Hood, and it's got Patrick Bergen and Uma Thurman in it. It's from 1991.
I am so gonna watch that.
And yeah, it is a much better film than Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, which is all flashy and everything, but a little bit silly when you look at it.
Yeah. But I mean, that being said, Morgan Freeman, that is the Robin Hood Prince of Thieves one, isn't it?
Yeah, Kevin Costner,
Yeah, Kevin
Martin.
Costner. Terrible accent. I don't know why. It's just like, we're
Was he
going
even
back
trying to
home.
do an accent?
No, but he's like, we're going home to England. I'm like, you don't belong in England.
You're the wrong continent.
Get out. But Morgan Freeman was excellent in that movie.
Yeah, so was Alan Rickman. They all pretty much
Alan.
did really well in spite of Kevin Costner,
Yeah, Alan Rickman was fantastic.
they? Sean Connery turning up at the end as King Richard,
As
which was
King
like
Richard, yeah.
Scottish King Richard.
I'm Scottish King Richard. I'd like to give the bride away. It's just like you can tell it's been made by Americans because they have no idea what the hell is going on.
Which is why Robin Hood Men in Tights works so well for me, because you've got Cary Elwes playing Robin Hood, and he says, "And unlike other Robin Hoods, I can speak with an English accent, and I'm man enough to wear tights." And the whole spoof is on the whole sort of you would have been wearing hose at the time, so
Yeah.
tights, which Kevin Costner absolutely refused to do.
Yeah, of course.
That's a hilariously funny Robin Hood spoof, if anyone wants to check that out.
So, where does the earliest Robin Hood really come from then? Do we know?
I don't think they know from before. I mean, the earliest record is 1377, which is the Piers Plowman, which is the narrative poem. But I don't think they know. There's a lot of theories that actually it predates that.
Yeah, which
And
wouldn't
if
surprise
it, no, I mean, if it was set around the 12th century, it might have originally come from some propaganda mixing with folklore about Robin Goodfellow, or, you
Yeah.
know, the man in the green, as it were.
So really having Robin Hood and King Arthur together is not that out of place.
Well, if King Arthur's supposed to be around sort of the 3rd or 4th century, you know, there's quite a gap there.
I'm really hurting you with this, aren't I?
Yes, you are. Brain's going to explode.
I'm gonna do this to you on purpose. That's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna write a series and you're gonna hate me for
you have to,
it.
ex you have, you absolutely have to explain why they're in the wrong century. I suppose that's the thing, though, because you don't know. He's an archetype in the same way that Arthur's an archetype. And while we think we can pinpoint some historical accuracy for where they should be, you can't be 100% sure. I mean, Arthur could have been several hundred years before, you know, yeah. the Celtic chieftain who came before the Saxons.
Yeah, I mean, Arthur could have been, you know, from 300 AD, even before that. He could have been based on Fionn Mac Cumhail.
Yeah, it could have been. And so, it's the same with Robin Hood. You know, he might go back way, way before the 12th century.
It just might not have been the first time. It might have been the first time he was put onto paper. But the story of Robin Hood is a very catchy name. And the kind of the motif. Let's talk about the motif of Robin. Because he is always depicted wearing green and sort of very earthy kind of colours.
Yeah, Lincoln green, isn't it?
Yeah, Lincoln green, which makes sense, obviously, because he's in a forest, he probably wants to camouflage a little bit. But I mean, wearing sort of green, you know, you think about the sort of the dye for that. Is it likely that he would have been wearing green? And then that makes me wonder whether he isn't more intrinsically linked with Robin Goodfellow.
Yeah. And I think that's where a lot of that comes from, you know, the sort of Puck type character.
Yeah.
And who was also a trickster and sort of a consort of the nature goddess as well, which is probably where Maid Marian may have come from.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, talk about Robin Goodfellow a little bit more.
Robin Goodfellow is an aspect of one of the Celtic gods. So it's a little bit different with Celtic mythology. While you can divide them up, at the end of the day, sort of all gods were considered to be one and all goddesses were considered to be aspects of one as well.
Yeah.
But instead of being, you know, the great nature deity who controlled the animals and carried the antlers of plenty and, you know, was all about fertility and that, Goodfellow was more to do with the slightly more magical aspect of the male deity, as it were. So he was portrayed as being sort of a slim youth with curly brown hair dressed in green and a pheasant feather in his hair. And a trickster. Later portraits give him, you know, a bow and arrow, a bit like Cupid in that respect. So,
yes,
not really bad, but not really up to a lot of good either.
Because he was quite domestic as well.
Yes.
And he was a nature spirit. And again, we have that trickster element, which goes back to one of our previous episodes. But he wasn't wicked. Per se. And, you know, they make a point, which is he was Robin Goodfellow or Puck or Hobgoblin.
Yeah.
And again, Hob could be changed to Rob. They actually do that in the BBC version where they say Robin of the Wood, or it's and it changes to Robin Hood.
Yes.
Stuff like that. to sort of why he would end up as called Robin Hood, especially when he was originally Robin of Locksley or Robert of Locksley. So you have Robin Goodfellow, and that is that kind of that green motif, and again the bow and arrow as well.
Yes.
So yeah, we might have the glorification of the bow and arrow from Agincourt, but I wonder whether, yeah, it doesn't come from something a little bit earlier on. And that kind of, there is an almost magical aspect of Robin, which is that he was able to kind of appear and disappear at will, and he was kind of one with the forest in a lot of ways, and he did pull a lot of tricks on people.
Yeah, you could see how you might have a historical character who is just an extremely good woodcraftsman who could just appear and disappear, as some of them do. We're good at fading back into the woods, as it were.
Yeah.
And how that could get all tied up with the sort of fairy folk and Robin Goodfellow, and then you get the image overlaying one, the image of the mythology laying over whatever historical figure you've got there.
Yeah. Plus there's probably the historical truth, which was that there would have been outlaws living in that forest.
Yes, it would have been a good place to hide out. It, you know, if you've got a really vast forest, it's quite difficult to find anyone in it.
Yeah. So,
and people avoided the forests as well, unless they had to go in to do anything. They tended to avoid it because, you know, in the same way that people didn't go about at night, it was really, really dark. So, no streetlights or anything. And as we've talked before about being out in the countryside when there's no light, the woods would have been even darker because you wouldn't have even got moonlight through them. If you've ever been in a mixed deciduous British forest or any forest that's deciduous, it's really, you know, quite dark, overgrown. You know, it wouldn't have been a safe place to be. We would have still had wolves and things then. They weren't extinct in Britain until sort of the 15th century.
Yeah. Well done, us.
Yes. And bears till the, I think, 17th century. So, you know, we did have large predators here at one point.
Yeah. So, large predators, outlaws, general kind of dangers of that are in a forest anyway, and when you can't sort of navigate in the dark, and the whole kind of the fact that we were all very, very, you know, worried about fairies and the supernatural. I say we, like I was there. which I might have been. So yeah, they wouldn't have gone in there. And it would have been a place for harbouring secrets and a place for harbouring the imagination. And there probably would have been outlaws who did rob very, very rich people. And when you're poor and you're starving, it's very, very likely that if your life is on the line and there's really nothing you can do legally to keep yourself fed and to keep your children fed, it's very easy to fall out of the law, to do stuff to survive.
Yeah.
So if we think that the outlaws were the ones who were sort of robbing people, the people who, when they attacked, they'd actually get something out of, then the kind of the take from the rich and give to the poor aspect is that they were the poor ones. They really were the poor ones.
I think it's worth looking at the origins of the outlaw in the English sense as well. This comes from a Saxon tradition, which was handed down from before the Dane law, whereby you made somebody niddig. Now, to make somebody niddig is to make them an unperson. So basically, their life holds no value, and anybody can murder them without repercussion. So that's where the original outlaw thing came from. So if somebody chose to live outside the law, then they were literally trading all their future. Because if anybody ever caught them, you know, there'd be no repercussion, no bodyguard, no wereguild for murdering them. There'd be no repercussion for it at all, because you'd just be getting rid of a pest.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be something you'd go into lightly.
So that would be, you know, that was something to get, you would literally need a pardon from the king, kind of in person. And pardons for being made niddig or being made outlaw were extremely rare.
Yeah. Robin got one, of course, because he saved England when good King Richard reappeared and went, oh yes, while I was away doing brave and excellent things.
With saucy French boys.
With saucy French boys.
You kind of don't blame him in a way in that respect, because English court was really boring at the time.
Yeah, well, I do hold him a little bit accountable for the fact he just went to another continent and was just there like, well, I don't like you. I mean, he said it was about sort of the religious kind of thing. It wasn't. He went to the Ottoman Empire to pillage it. That's what he was there for. They were there to pillage. He was there to have fun.
Basically, he was throwback to our Nordic forebears who liked to go elsewhere and conquer and take their stuff.
Yeah.
Which unfortunately does still kind of persist within the Brits even today.
Yeah. And so what he did was he arrived there, murdered a bunch of people, was a generally horrific person. As I said, he went to Cyprus, enslaved the whole island, built a castle there, stayed there for his honeymoon for a bit, and then kind of just went off. So I don't really have a lot of sympathy for Richard.
No.
He was a mass murderer. So yeah, a lot of sympathy for Robin Hood, because he was the people's hero.
Yes. And that's probably why it is so enduring. That and the fact that the entire myth is just full of archetypes that people respond to, isn't it? You know, the disobedient but good-hearted lady, and even the slightly drunken friar.
Yeah.
You know, as the slightly more fun version of the church.
Yeah. The huge best friend with the, you know, the gentle giant with the heart of gold.
Yes.
Who's called Little.
That there is something there for everyone to see themselves in, and the idea that they're being a bit naughty, but ultimately they're doing good things as well.
Yeah.
So much more interesting than working inside the law, isn't it, in that respect?
Yeah. They're not doing what the law says, but they're doing what is morally right.
Yes.
The way it's been introduced to us. And I think so long as there remains a class system, it will prevail. And I think, you know, at the moment, the class system is growing wider every yeah. year at the moment in England. We have a huge divide in the class system where a lot of people just can't afford to feed themselves. And I think what the top... some of the richest people in England sort of like I don't even know the statistics, but it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I don't think the Robin Hood myth is going anywhere anytime soon.
No, I'd agree with that. And we have kind of come to an end there, so
yeah.
The end of our lovable rogues episode.
Love that guy. Love that fox. So, on that note, well, thanks and goodbye, guys.
Yeah, thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.